Pharisees heard that Jesus was winning and baptizing more disciples than John. Actually, Jesus himself did not baptize anyone, only his disciples did. So when Jesus heard what was being said, he left Judea and went back to Galilee. On his way there, he had to go through Samaria. In Samaria, he came to a town named Sychar, which was not far from the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by the trip, sat down by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw some water.
Give me a drink of water.
His disciples had gone into town to buy food.
You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. So how can you ask me for a drink?
Jews will not use the same cups and bowls that Samaritans use.
If you only knew what God gives, and who it is that is asking you for a drink, you would ask him. And he would give you a life-giving water.
Sir, you don't have a bucket and the well is deep. Where would you get that life-giving water? It was our ancestor Jacob who gave us this well. He and his children and his flocks all drank from it. You don't claim to be greater than Jacob, do you?
Those who drink this water will get thirsty again. But those who drink the water that I will give them will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give them will become in them a spring, which will provide them with life-giving water and give them eternal life.
Sir, give me that water. Then I will never be thirsty again. Nor will I have to come here to draw water.
Go and call your husband and come back.
I don't have a husband.
You are right when you say you don't have a husband. You've been married to 5 men and the man you live with now is not really your husband. You have told me the truth.
You are a prophet, sir. My Samaritan ancestors worshipped God on this mountain. But you Jews say that Jerusalem is the place where we should worship God.
Believe me, woman. The time will come when people will not worship the Father either on this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans do not really know whom you worship. But we Jews know whom we worship because it is from the Jews that salvation comes. But the time is coming. And is already here, when by the power of God's Spirit, people will worship the Father as he really is, offering him the true worship that he wants. God is Spirit, and only by the power of his Spirit can people worship him as he really is.
I know that the Messiah will come, and when he comes, he will tell us everything.
I am he. I who am talking with you.
At that moment, Jesus' disciples returned, and they were greatly surprised to find him talking with a woman. But none of them said to her, "What do you want?" or asked him, "Why are you talking with her?"
That is a dramatization of our passage this morning. It's John chapter 4, verses 1 through 26. Though the wording may be unfamiliar, it is straight from the Bible, word for word, from what is known as the Good News Translation. And it's tough for me to say just a little bit about various translations. I either have to say a lot or not much at all, so I'm just going to let that stand. It's fine. It's not a translation I like for a variety of reasons, but I chose this clip because I really like the way it captured the flow of the interaction, the interpersonal dynamics of this relatively well-known conversation, which, if not as well-known, as the one in chapter 3, is not far behind. From Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus in John 3, we get, "You must be born again." And John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." From Jesus' conversation with the woman at the well in John 4, we get, verse 24, "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." In the version this video is based on, that's read as, "God is spirit, and only by the power of his spirit can people worship him as he really is." The direct translation and traditional wording, which I strongly prefer, is, "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." Amen. Granted, it's not as famous as John 3:16, but it's B-list famous, well-known enough to reverberate in the cultural consciousness, rings a bell, so to speak, so that many people supplied with the first half, "God is spirit, and those who worship him," could supply the second half, "must worship him in spirit and truth." The wording is familiar, if not the reference, John 4:24. And as we attend to the passage this morning, we'll focus not exactly on that verse, 4:24, but on something in the verse which precedes it, verse 23. Together, those verses read, "The hour is coming and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." We'll focus on that last phrase in verse 23. "The Father is seeking such to worship him." God is looking for something. He's after something. He's on a quest for true worshipers, those who worship in spirit and truth. The Father is seeking such to worship him. And the thing I want to impress on you this morning is the astounding fact that God is seeking such worshipers. And he is doing so seriously, so diligently, that he'll consider anyone for that position. In John chapter 3, Jesus converses with a ruler of the chosen people, the Jews. In John chapter 4, he engages an outcast of the rejected people, the Samaritans. In earthly terms, Nicodemus and the woman at the well could not be more different. He's a Jew, she's a Gentile, and the worst kind of Gentile, a Samaritan. We'll get to that. He's a man, she's a woman, he's a success, she's a failure. He's educated, she's ignorant, he's rich, she's poor, he seeks Jesus out, she bumps into him by accident. Any way you look at these two, any measure you apply to them, he's at one end and she is at the other. He's on the top, she's on the bottom. But something about Jesus levels the ground, causes those enormous earthly differences to become irrelevant. When the light shines in the darkness, it just shines on people. That's all. The Father is not looking for successes or failures. He's not looking for Jews or Gentiles. He's not looking for males or females. He is seeking true worshipers, whoever they might be, wherever he can find them. He is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And it doesn't matter if they're successful Jewish men or outcast Samaritan women. The successful Jewish man and the outcast Samaritan woman have equal need, and the successful Jewish man and the outcast Samaritan woman have equal opportunity to worship God in spirit and truth. The failure does not need to become a success. The Gentile does not need to become a Jew. The female does not need to become a male. The person on whom the light shines needs to become a true worshiper. That's all that matters. That is who God is after. And anyone who worships him in spirit and truth is the right kind of person. They're the success stories. They're the winners by his measure. And his is the only measure that matters. The only one that lasts. So whether you're a respected Jewish male or an outcast Samaritan female or somewhere in between, as most of us are, pay attention. Listen up. God wants you to worship him in spirit and truth. He is seeking you for that purpose. The inversion of worldly standards is a common and consistent theme in Scripture. When the Lord sent Samuel to anoint a son of Jesse to be king of Israel, Samuel looked at Jesse's eldest son, Eliab, and thought, he looks good, I guess he's the guy. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So, one after the other, seven sons of Jesse passed before Samuel, and the Lord kept saying, not that one, not that one, till it appeared they were done. And Samuel turned to Jesse and said, do you have any other sons? And he said, well, there's the runt, the little one, he's out tending sheep. His name's David. Why don't you send for him? He may be the guy. When Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, dreamt a dream unfolding the history of the world, he didn't understand it, couldn't get it. So he summoned all the geniuses, all the Nobel Prize winners in his realm, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers. But they couldn't even describe the dream, let alone interpret it. And he found that irritating. So he decided to put them all to death. Way, way, way down that list was a new kid, an arrival from the recently conquered kingdom of Judah, who was going to be put to death with all the rest of them. So upon hearing about that, he said, would you give me an opportunity to pray about this? And they did. And he prayed. And God showed him the answer. They called him Belteshazzar, but his real name was Daniel. He was brought before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king said to him, are you able to make known to me the dream and its interpretation? Daniel replied, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. It may not jump out to you, but note how Nebuchadnezzar automatically, instinctively, wants to credit Daniel with the achievement. Are you able to make known to me the dream? Daniel deflects that. It's not about wise men or astrologers. It's not about magicians or soothsayers or even about him. It's about the God who is in heaven. He's the one who reveals secrets. This consistent violation of human standards and values is to focus our attention where it belongs. After Daniel had explained to Nebuchadnezzar the dream and its interpretation, Nebuchadnezzar did not say to him, "Truly, you are the magician of magicians." Nebuchadnezzar said to him, "Truly, your God is the God of gods." That's where the focus should be. That's where the credit belongs. That is why God binds us to himself by grace and faith. By grace, we have been saved through faith, and that not of ourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. It's why God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world, and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things which are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. 1 Corinthians 1:27 through 29. It's a very simple but very consistent inversion. And we need to be reminded of it over and over, because if we're not, we get to thinking somebody like a respected Jewish man must be in real good with God. But somebody like a despised Samaritan woman wouldn't have a chance with him. And that is why John 4 comes right after John 3. Let's step through the text. John 4, verses 1 through 4. "Therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself did not baptize but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria." Within the flow of the narrative, Jesus is moving to avoid problems. There's a strong emphasis on timing in John's gospel. Might think back to the first sign, Cana, chapter 2, water into wine there. His mother Mary had brought that up to him. Do you remember what Jesus said to her? "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." The night he's betrayed, John 17, verse 1, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, "Father, the hour has come." Here in our text, he says to the woman, verse 23, "The hour is coming and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth." The point is, timing matters. And Jesus is in charge of the timing. He won't be early and he won't be late. He won't be hurried and he won't be delayed. Here at the start of John 4, he's leaving center stage, Jerusalem, because things are starting to heat up there, and he won't permit them to come to a head too soon. So he departs for Galilee in the north, 3 days' journey from Jerusalem, straight north. But if you go straight north, you have to go through Samaria. And Jews didn't like to go through Samaria. They usually went out of their way, traveled miles further and days longer to avoid going through Samaria. So let's talk about the Samaritans. They were uniquely reviled by the Jews because they were a people of mixed race and mixed religion. 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, God's people, the Jews, were unified in the land under one king. It's called the time of the united monarchy. First king was Saul, then was David, then was Solomon. But when Solomon died about 930 BC, the one kingdom split in two. 10 tribes in the north, called Israel, 2 tribes in the south, called Judah. The northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians in 722 BC. The southern kingdom fell to the Babylonians in 586 BC. Babylonian exile lasted 70 years. People returned, rebuilt the temple, rebuilt the city. That's Ezra, Nehemiah. That's the history of the southern kingdom, which remained authentically Jewish. But in the north, the Assyrian conquerors had employed their standard policy whereby they transplanted conquered peoples. They moved the peoples they had conquered around. It made them easier to manage. So what happened is in the north is that while a few Jews remained there, many foreigners were imported. This is where the 10 lost tribes story comes from. The practical result on the ground was hybridization, a hybrid people and a hybrid religion. This is summarized in 2 Kings chapter 17, but in the centuries that followed, the Samaritans, as they became known, developed a story about their history. And in that story, they claimed they were the true descendants and the people in the south were the apostates. Can you say projection? They even developed, that is, forged their own scriptures. It's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. It's essentially a copy of the Law of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, almost an exact copy, just a few changes. One of them being the Ten Commandments include the command to build an altar on Mount Gerizim. That's Exodus 20, verse 18 of the Samaritan Pentateuch. And if you want to know more about the Samaritan Pentateuch, ask Bob Morris, because I just shot my bolt on the whole thing. But it follows that the temple should be located on Mount Gerizim in Samaria rather than Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. That's the conflict. And they eventually built a temple on Mount Gerizim by permission of Alexander the Great. Josephus tells us, about 330 BC. That temple was destroyed by the Jews in 128 BC, but the Samaritans, with their false religion and their counterfeit Bible, were still there in the time of Jesus. In fact, they are still there today. About 1,000 of them. A highly inbred group, but they are there. Well, back to John's 4, Jacob's well, where this encounter takes place, is near Mount Gerizim, which is what the woman is referring to when she says, verse 20, our fathers worshipped on this mountain. And you Jews say Jerusalem is the place where we ought to worship. So, that's a brief overview of the history of the Samaritans and why they were despised by the Jews. But Jesus chose, the text intriguingly says, verse 4, he needed to go through Samaria. So picking it up at verses 5 and 6, so he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. That is to say, it was noon, which was not the normal time to draw water. That would normally be done in the morning and or in the evening, not in the heat of the day. But this woman comes by herself at this unusual time, which telegraphs to us, the reader, there's something wrong with her. She is something of an outcast. Verses 7 and 8. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me a drink. For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. It would have been socially edgy for any man to address any woman in those isolated circumstances, but it was outlandish, shading into bizarre, for a Jewish man to address a Samaritan woman about anything, let alone obtaining a drink of water. Since her Samaritan uncleanness would be transmitted to him through the vessels she touched. But Jesus was apparently not bound by these conventions and asks her to get him a drink. She quite reasonably responds, verse 9, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." But Jesus was no ordinary Jew. He's on a mission from the Father. He's looking for true worshipers. Perhaps she is, or could become one. Now, he was genuinely thirsty. He wasn't faking it, but he couldn't pass up even this mundane opportunity to shine his light. She'd asked a perfectly reasonable question. He replies with a spiritually intriguing answer. Verse 10, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." We just read, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. It's important to understand Samaritans had no dealings with Jews either. The Samaritans did not see themselves as inferior. They looked at the Jews just like the Jews looked at them. She wasn't honored or flattered that a Jew had spoken to her. And she could have blown him off, told him to get his own darn water if he wanted it. But she very politely, perhaps playfully, replied, verse 11, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?" Then she takes it up a notch. She's got some spiritual cards to play. "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and livestock?" And again, understand the "our" and the "us" there are not inclusive. When she says "our father Jacob," she means our Samaritan father Jacob. When she says "who gave us the well," means gave us Samaritans the well. They saw themselves as legitimate and the Jews as imposters. From her point of view, though she may well have been on the bottom rung of Samaritan society, at least thank God she was a Samaritan and not a Jew. That's how she saw it. And if she had wanted to stand on that, she could have blown him off and walked away at any time. But she's playing along. Jesus replies, verses 13 and 14, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." Now it's getting kind of crazy. Pretty weird. But she, probably wistfully, replies, verse 15, "Sir, give me some of this water, that I may thirst and not come here to draw." Oh, if only that were true. If only that kind of water was really available. Up to this point, it's been playful. A little bit of cross-cultural fun. She has probably enjoyed not being judged. Just interacting with somebody, anybody, even a Jew, in a manner where all the baggage of her life is not the issue. That's about to change. As Jesus says, "Go, call your husband and come here." On the surface, that's a perfectly socially appropriate thing to say. It would be our distortion to read sexual innuendo into any of this. But setting aside the Jew-Samaritan dynamic, the overarching cultural norm dictated the conversation they were having should be with her husband. But when Jesus says, "Go call your husband," he's talking about something way deeper than the cultural norms. It was about something he knew and something she knew, though she didn't know he knew. But in any event, the fun was over. But we should note that Jesus does not broach this until he has established with her rapport. The fact she didn't have a husband, her whole personal mess, did not keep him from engaging her. If you're going to help somebody who's drowning, you have got to swim out to them as they are drowning. If you want to condemn them for drowning, or if you want to shout swimming instructions to them, that's easy to do. You can do that from the bank. Just yell. If you actually want to participate in saving them, you have got to go out to them as they are drowning. Yes, it's risky. Yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, it's messy. All of that stuff. But if you want to actually do something about it, that's what you've got to do. Jesus is looking for true worshipers. In the normal human framework, her personal mess would appear to disqualify her from that. But we're in the Bible. This is Jesus. He keeps upsetting that framework. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. The people invited to the wedding didn't want to come, so he's pulling bums and whores off the street into the wedding feast. He not only knows all about her personal mess, he knows, in a sense, it is to her advantage. In this sense, he knows she cannot be under any illusions about having it all together. None of this doing just fine stuff. It's not where she lives. Nobody knows better than her the catastrophe she is living. The grace, the love, the hope Jesus brings leads him to engage her, establish relationship with her before addressing the problem, rather than letting the problem keep him from engaging with her. Now, the problem is real. It needs to be addressed. She's drowning, but he has shown her he's not there to condemn her for drowning. Nor is he there to shout swimming instructions from the bank. He has, so to speak, swum out to her, made contact with her. But she still has to accept the help. Don't forget, she could walk away any time. She is under no obligation to this Jewish whatever he is, who just popped the pleasant bubble of their talk about magic water and recalled her to the pain of her existence. Go call your husband. She replies with the truth, if not the whole truth, I have no husband. It's true enough, vulnerable enough for Jesus to disclose himself more. You have well said, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. Frankly, there was something wrong with her. We do not know what it was, but there was something wrong. The Samaritans essentially followed the law of Moses, which permitted divorce. So it appears she has been divorced five times. The wife could not divorce the husband. Only the husband could divorce the wife. So she has been put aside five times. She is a five-time loser. Some commentators from, I think, a perhaps well-intended but misguided sense of chivalry suggest perhaps she'd been widowed several times. Seems rather a stretch to me. and hardly accounts for the fact that she is now living with a man outside of marriage. There was something unseemly about her. We are simply not told what it was. Maybe it was physical, maybe it was psychological, doesn't matter. Whatever it was, she was a mess. And this Jew had now just brought it all up. No more playful discussion about living water. It's as serious and as painful as it could possibly be. Her response, verses 19 and 20, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." I especially liked the way this was presented in the video, because the standard interpretation here is that she's trying to escape the spotlight. It just got way too personal, so she's going to toss out a theological red herring to change the subject. Maybe, but Jesus responds to it as if it's a sincere question. And that is the way I read the account. It was the question, the issue between the Jews and the Samaritans. And this messy woman was spiritually hungry. When your life's a mess, it makes you spiritually hungry because you don't have any of the false temporary satisfaction coming in from the world. That's all off the table. And it makes you wonder if maybe there's not something beyond the world. It's deeper, realer, truer. Jesus says to her, verse 21 and 22, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." Jesus does not sidestep the big question. There is no mamby-pamby, "Well, you do it your way," or "You're doing it the best you can," or "It's all good, we're all seeking God." He says, "You are wrong. We are right. Salvation is of the Jews." But the big religious problem, just like her personal problem, was not wielded as a club against her. It's communicated by one who has already shown he is there to help her. He's on her side. Jesus continues, "The hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." She then confesses her genuine, if imperfect, Samaritan faith. "I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." And this mess of a Samaritan woman, this loser of losers, by virtue of her childlike honesty, sincerity, and awareness of her need, prompts as full, as complete, as direct a revelation of himself as Jesus ever offered. "I, who speak to you, am he." Click. Drop the curtain, bring up the house lights. We're calling that good. Now she's going to run off, but she is not running away. She's running home to go tell everybody about this guy. Happy ending. We'll follow it up next week. But I want to close by watching that video again, though I'll preface it with a quote from C.S. Lewis. In his essay, The Weight of Glory, it speaks for itself. He said, "Remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. Or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in light of these overwhelming possibilities. It is with the awe and circumspection proper to them that we should conduct all our dealings with one another. All friendships, all love, all play, all politics, there are no ordinary people. You have never met a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. And their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendor.
A Samaritan woman came to draw some water.
Give me a drink of water.
His disciples had gone into town to buy food.
You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. So how can you ask me for a drink?
Jews will not use the same cups and bowls that Samaritans use.
If you only knew what God gives, and who it is that is asking you for a drink, you would ask him. And he would give you a life-giving water.
Sir, you don't have a bucket and the well is deep. Where would you get that life-giving water? It was our ancestor Jacob who gave us this well. He and his children and his flocks all drank from it. You don't claim to be greater than Jacob, do you?
Those who drink this water will get thirsty again. But those who drink the water that I will give them will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give them will become in them a spring, which will provide them with life-giving water and give them eternal life.
Sir, give me that water. Then I will never be thirsty again. Nor will I have to come here to draw water.
Go and call your husband and come back.
I don't have a husband.
You are right when you say you don't have a husband. You've been married to 5 men and the man you live with now is not really your husband. You have told me the truth.
You are a prophet, sir. My Samaritan ancestors worshipped God on this mountain. But you Jews say that Jerusalem is the place where we should worship God.
Believe me, woman. The time will come when people will not worship the Father either on this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans do not really know whom you worship. But we Jews know whom we worship because it is from the Jews that salvation comes. But the time is coming. And is already here, when by the power of God's Spirit, people will worship the Father as he really is, offering him the true worship that he wants. God is Spirit, and only by the power of his Spirit can people worship him as he really is.
I know that the Messiah will come, and when he comes, he will tell us everything.
I am he. I who am talking with you.